crew up there. I know that I run the story to you, but I'm legitimately over how cheap this fooling is on today. This has got a happy price. Cost $20, $400 for 20 volumes. Just look at the volumes. $20 a volume.
Would you be able to tell us what it used to be? What it hasn't gone?
Yes, it used to be. Yes, it used to be in the old days, it used to be cheap, but then there wasn't the money. Nobody had the money for it, you see. And today, it's so cheap. If you want a book on a technical subject, a quarter of the size of this costs you $40-$50 straight away. So just look at this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we are, I think it's chapter 7, just to be in that spot. There's chapter 7. Yes, chapter 7, verse 9. Thank you, Betty.
I shall put it to you.
Now, you remember last week we dealt with the subject of a great battle is about to take place, and there were 30,000 Bnei Yisrael who gathered for the battle, and Hashem said first of all that those who were afraid, they must go back, and then they were left about 10,000. Then after that, Hashem said that 10,000 were still too many for this battle. And I discussed with you why 10,000 were too many, and Hashem said that there was a test, that Gideon must take the men down to the water, and anybody who put his head down to the water and drank, that person was disqualified, and the person who scooped the water up in his hand and drank from his hand, that person would qualify for war, and only 300 remained. Those who did not go down on their knees and put their mouths to the water but brought the water up to their hands, there were only 300. And Hashem says to Gideon, now these are the 300 that go into battle. So he goes into battle with 300 men against an army of many, many tens of thousands, probably at a minimum of 150,000. Amalekites, Midianites all gathered, and he's got only 300 men. And we went into great detail last week to discuss what kind of a test it was. The lapping up of the water while drinking from the hand. Why was that better than going down and drinking from the pool? We gave various reasons for that. Now, we are at the stage tonight where the battle is ready to begin. Gideon has got 300 men, and we are told that the Midianites and the Amalekites, we just couldn't count them. They were just, the whole valley was full of them. And now, something interesting happens in verse 9. In verse 9 of chapter 7, we've got Vayehi Balaylo Haru Vayomer Elov Adonai Kum Rei B'Machaneh Ki Nesati B'Yodecho. And that night, Hashem says to Gideon, he's the general, he's the leader, arise, go down into the camp, that is, into the camp of the Midianites and the Amalekites of the enemy, because I have given it into your hand. I have delivered the camp into your hand. Now, that is what Hashem tells him to do. And now Hashem qualifies it and says, Ve'im yoreato lo reze, and if you are afraid to go down, reidato ufuro narecho elamane, then you and Puro, your aid, the two of you go down to the camp of the enemy. And don't forget, this is in the night time. The two of you go down to the camp of the enemy. The show ma to ma yedabeiru. And you will hear what they are saying. That is what the enemy is saying. The achal techazakno yodecho. And after that, you will strengthen your hands. your hands will be strengthened. And you will be yoradetoba machane. And you will go down upon the camp. So Hashem tells him, if you are afraid, then do that. Listen to what they are saying. Vayerehu ufuro naro yaketzeach hamushim asher b'machaneh, and he and Puro, his aide, go down to the edge of the camp, of the enemy's camp, where the armed men are. Because the way they arranged their camp in those days was in the very center of the camp they put the animals, the horses, the camels, the donkeys, in the very center of the camp. Round the camp they put the people who do not go out to battle. The cooks and these people, that they were round that. And after that they started putting the soldiers, and round the camp, on the outermost edge of the camp, they put the infantry, those soldiers who were the best trained there, on the outer rim of the camp, because they also acted as the sentries and the guards. So they came up to the edge of Hamushim, where the armed soldiers were, Asheba Makaneh, which was in the camp. In verse 12, Umidyon Ba'amolek V'chobene Kedem Notlim Bo'emek Kof Arbeloro. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the inhabitants of the east were lying in the valley as locusts for multitude. The Libaleev Amispor Kahola Sher Kahochi Al Safasa Yomlerov, and the one just couldn't count their camels. It was like the sand on the seashore. You just couldn't begin counting them at all. This was the army that they had to face. By Yover Gideon, and Gideon came. Now, so what happened was, he's going, the two of them are going, Gideon and Puro, his aide, and when they come nearer to the camp, he leaves the aide, it's in the night time, and he himself crawls down to the very edge of the camp. And Gideon overhears a man telling another man what he had dreamt. Vayomer, and he said he dreamt as follows. Hine chalom cholamti, behold, I dreamt a dream. Vehine tzlil lechem se'oli mishapech b'machaneh midyon. And there was a cake of barley, bread, a cake of bread, or a slice of bread, a slice would be better, tzlil lechem se'oli, a slice of barley bread, mishapech b'machaneh midyon. Now, in the English I've got here is tumbled. It's quite a good translation. I'll have to come back to it. Tumbling into the camp of the Midianites, by your bow adro oel, and it came as far as the tent, by your keu, and it hit the tent, by hippol, and the tent fell, by your havcheu lemalo, and the slice of bread overturned the tent. The nofar oel, and then the tent fell down. So the slice of bread hit the tent fell down, and it must have fallen on the slice of bread. Then the slice of bread turned the tent over again, and the slice of bread landed on top of the tent, on top of the collapsed tent. Vayan re'eu vayomer, and his friend answered and said, Ein zos beauty im cheret Gideon ben Yoash ish Yisrael. The meaning of the dream is that this is none other than Gideon, than the sword of Gideon, the son of Yoash, of Israel. No sanu Elohim b'yodel es Midyon es kol ha-machaneh. God has given into his hand Midyon and all the camp. Now, let us rest there. So we've got five verses, and we can consider those five verses. Now, is there anything that anyone finds strange about these five verses? Yes.
Well, first of all, Hashem tells him to go down.
Yes.
Because if you're afraid, I mean, if he believed in Hashem, he was his general, why would he be afraid? If Hashem says go down, I would say, yes, sir, and go right on down.
Right. That's all it is. If Hashem tells him to go down, and then Hashem says, the ingurayatu, and if you are afraid, then you and Puru go down to the camp. And he does go down to the camp, so that means he is afraid. If Hashem tells him, go down, and I have given the camp, I have delivered the camp into your hands, what is it that he can be afraid of? Any suggestions to the answer, to the question? Any suggestions as an answer to the question? And he doesn't say he's afraid. Gideon doesn't say he's afraid. But Hashem says, if you are afraid, then go down.
Is it because of the man, because of his man?
And he does go down, no. And he does go down, which shows he is afraid. But Hashem himself tells him, don't be afraid. I know a person who went in on holiday, and he leaves the house, and the treasure's in that house. He said, aren't you afraid to leave the house? He said, no, it's insured. So I said to him, and what happens if the insurance doesn't pay out? He says, no, they've got to pay out. He's not afraid. He's certain. He's got confidence. He's got trust in the insurance company. They'll pay out. He's got nothing to be afraid of. What greater insurance can one have that Hashem says to him, I've delivered it into your hands. But if you are afraid, then do this. That is the difficult question. And that is the question that I want to discuss with you tonight. Now, I'm going to put another question to you. I'm sure you know the story that when Avraham was living in Babylon, before Hashem appeared to him, the edict went out. Well, it's not an edict, it was just understood that everyone had to serve idols. It was an idolatrous society. Everybody had to serve idols. Avraham is the only one that won't serve idols. So they reasoned with him and reasoned with him. He refused to serve any idols. He believes only in one God. So they threw him into a fiery furnace, and he was saved. Do you know that story?
But his brother going in the furnace.
Are we pardon?
His brother going in the furnace.
No, he went into the furnace. That's all we've got to do. He went into the furnace, and he was saved. Now, just to get the story straight, when he went into the furnace, did he know he was going to be saved? Had no idea that he didn't think he was going to be saved. He was certain that he was going to. So if you are certain that you're going to be burnt, then why do you go into the fire? Because of his convictions and his principles. Because of his convictions and his principles, he's prepared to be killed. That is the story. There's another story. Hashem tells him to take his only son, and he takes his only son, and he's prepared to offer him up as an offering, and Hashem intervenes in the middle of the act, towards the end of the act, and he's not. And that story is called the Akedah. Story of the Akedah. Have you heard of that story? Anybody heard of that story? But you've heard of the first story too. How do you know the first story? How do you know about it? Your Rebbe told it to you. And how do you know the story of the Akedah? It's in the Chumash. So how do you know the story about the that he was prepared, he went into the fire? From where do you know it? In the Torah there are only three words to tell us about that story. Three words. Behold Saiso Meur Kasbi. And you took him out of the furnace of the Babylonians. That's all that is mentioned. From that we know. Nothing else is mentioned. On Rosh Hashanah we don't read it, but the Akedah we read in Rosh Hashanah. The Akedah, a whole chapter is devoted to the Akedah. Which was a greater act? That he's prepared to throw himself into the furnace, prepared to give his life, or the Akedah? Which is the greater act? At least we would say both are equally great. Why all the attention to the second act and not to the first act? That is what we've got to understand. There must be a reason for it. Am I making the question clear? Because if you don't understand the question, then the answer doesn't mean anything. Any suggestions to answer that question?
I would have thought that the sacrifice of a child was a bigger sacrifice.
Why?
Because, well, for a number of reasons. In the first place, as a father, I know I would feel that way, but beyond that, the child represents his future.
Very good. Can you take that a little bit further?
If he had the power to understand and to see the future, and I believe he did, and he recognized it representing the future of the Jewish people as well, since he was the descendants of Yitzchak, of himself, Yitzchak, and going on to Yaakov and the rest, as he was willing to cut it off at that point, he was really talking about killing a lot of future people, you know, the whole Jewish people. Is that?
You're absolutely right.
If he kills himself, he's also cutting off his future, and the future of the others.
Yes. Well, right, but that was before God appeared to him. He didn't know yet that he was going to be the father of the people. He didn't know.
That's the point in itself. In one case, he was told to do it. In the other case, it was entirely voluntary.
The first one should be second grade.
So it's what is the rabbi tells us? It's harder to do something that's disagreeable when you're told to do it than when you are not told to do it.
Certainly both. But now just look what happens here. When he threw himself into the furnace and allowed himself to be thrown into the furnace, and he's giving his life, what moves him to do it? It's something that's intellectual. He's come to the conclusion that there is only one God. That is what he believes in. That is his conviction. That is his principle, and it's wrong to serve idols. He'll be compromising a conclusion that he reached after all these years. He wanted to know what is reality, and he came to the conclusion that there is a creator of the universe, and it is he who is to be served. It is something that is intellectual. When it comes to throwing, to offering up Yitzchak, now, Irv Stokes is absolutely right. Is it intellectual? It's just the reverse of intellectual. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. He is told that from Yitzchak there will be a people. Now he is told he must sacrifice Yitzchak. Nothing will remain. It just doesn't make sense. That's not intellectual. It doesn't make sense, and yet he does it. Why does he do it? Because Hashem tells him to do it. That is why the second act is a greater act than the first. It's something that is against his intellect. So if it's against his intellect, then what must it be? His faith. Then it is his faith. So faith goes beyond. Faith goes beyond that which is intellectual. So it can work out that a person can have full understanding of what the Torah is. Full understanding, and he knows the Torah. Faith, that is a different thing. He might not have faith. We can go further, that a person can know the Torah and carry out all the mitzvahs of the Torah, but when it comes to a question of faith, hasn't got any faith. Now, this is something that I just want to speak to you for a little while. You've heard me say many times that the foundation of Musar is found in two short chapters, and they are both in the Masilah Shishurim, and the one follows immediately upon the other. The first chapter is the introduction, and the second is the first chapter of the Masilah Shishurim. Few pages. Very good. If we do not look into and analyze the question of what constitutes true fear of God, and that is Yiras Hashem, fear of God. Now, in service to Hashem, there are various aspects of service to Hashem, and each one is obligatory. For example, there must be fear of God, and there must be love of God. Now, there can't be love of God unless there is fear of God. So, there must be love of God, there is fear of God. And now, the Masilas Yeshurim says that if we do not look into and analyze the question of what constitutes true fear of God and what its ramifications are, how will we acquire it and how will we escape worldly vanity which renders our hearts forgetful of it? Will it not be forgotten and go lost even though we recognize its necessity? So one can recognize its necessity intellectually, but one hasn't got fear of God. One hasn't got intellectually. I can understand it, I can recognize it, I know the necessity for it, but I haven't got it. Love of God too, if we do not make an effort to implant it in our hearts, utilizing all the means which direct us towards it, how will it exist within us? Whence will it enter into our soul's intimacy and with ardor towards the Blessed One and towards His Torah, if we do not give heart to His greatness and majesty which engender this intimacy in our hearts? Now, and so he goes on. And he quotes a verse in Proverbs. The verse in Proverbs is, if you seek it as silver and search for it as gold, then you will understand the fear of God. And he really goes to school on this. If you seek it as silver and search for it as gold, then you will understand the fear of God. Now, I have seen the search for gold, what goes on. In the history books of California, you also know a little bit what people did for their search of gold. Gave their lives to try and find some gold. Went into all places. So Shlomo says, if you seek it as silver and search for it as gold, then you will understand the fear of God. He says, he does not say, then you will understand philosophy, then you will understand astronomy, then you will understand medicine, then you will understand legal judgments and these decisions. We see then that for fear of God to be understood, it must be sought as silver and searched for as gold. All this is part of our heritage and is accepted in substance by every devout individual. And then he goes on again to say that you can know the necessity for it, but how difficult it is to achieve it. We've got a verse in Deuteronomy. And now, O Israel, what doth Hashem your God require of you, that you fear Hashem your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. So, what is the first thing? What is it that God requires of you? To fear the Lord thy God. That is in Achan. That you fear the Lord thy God. That to fear the Lord your God. Then it goes on to say, Lo leches b'chol drocho, to go into all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, to observe his commandments, the commandments of Hashem, and to observe his statutes, to do his statutes, and so forth. But the first thing is to fear the Lord your God. Just listen to the words. And now, Israel, what is it that the Lord your God asks of you? Only to fear the Lord your God. So the Gemara asks the question, is fear of God something that is small? Is it something that is small?
No.
And the Gemara answers, but who says it? It's Moshe that is saying it. For to Moshe, it is a small thing. We ask the question if it's a small thing to Moshe, but it's not a small thing to us. And the answer is, it is within the reach of the human being. So a human being, if Moshe Rabbeinu reached it, so anybody can reach it. It is within the reach of the human being. But the Gemara asks, is it such a small thing? So the Gemara takes it that it's not a small thing. It is something that is very difficult to achieve. So one can have all the intellectual equipment, one can understand it and everything, understand it all. When it comes to actually fearing God, that is a different thing altogether. So this is the most difficult thing of all. That is why the Akedo, we make a great fuss of the Akedo. For a person to give his life for a conviction, he can do. That he can do. But when it comes to fearing God, then even if something doesn't make sense, but out of fear of God, if God tells him to do it, there is just no question about it. That is the faith that comes from Yiron. Now, when the Rambam speaks about the character of man, what man must be, his thesis in that, and he discusses it in two places. One, he just mentions it, and one, he goes into great detail. He says that the idea is that man must develop his character. How does he develop his character? Got to work on it. And the Rambam says that every attribute that the human being has is there for a good reason. The only thing is, we misuse it, we abuse it, or we use it to a wrong degree. We use it in the wrong measure, and so instead of it being a virtue, it becomes a vice. And the Rambam explains that in the Hebrew language, in Loshon HaKodesh, there is no word for virtue and vice, but there is a word, mido, mido tovo, and mido ro. Literally, mido tovo, which is translated as a virtue, is good measure. Mido ro, which is translated as a vice, is bad measure. Good measure and bad measure. Depends on the measure. If a person is only pity, he's got compassion. If he's a doctor, a young girl has got cancer of the leg, the only way he can save her life is by doing an operation. Hasn't got the heart, he's got too much compassion. Take off a leg of a girl, she can't go dancing, she can't meet boys afterwards, what's going to happen to her? He can't bring himself to do the operation. Is that compassion? Compassion it is, but to the wrong degree. It's too much of it. Too much. A father cannot discipline a child. He thinks it's child abuse if he disciplines a child. If a child wants something, he doesn't say no. He hasn't got the heart to say no. He's got too much compassion on the child. The child is naughty. Can't hit the child. The child rips up the furniture, rips up the upholstery. Can't bring himself to hit the child. He's got so much compassion. It's bad. That becomes a mido ro. Compassion there is not a virtue. The compassion there is a vice. So it is something that one has to have in the right measure. On the other hand, when the surgeon has got to take off that leg from the young girl, he employs azorius, he employs cruelty. But it is in the right place, at the right time, in the right measure, then it is a virtue, it is not a vice. When a father's got to hit a child, of course he employs the attribute of cruelty. Of course it is. But that is why we've got cruelty implanted in us. It is necessary to have it, so that we are able to discipline a child. The surgeon is able to perform the surgery. The judge is able to give the sentence. So he does exercise cruelty, but it is a necessary attribute, and if he exercises it in the right measure, the right time, the right place, it becomes a virtue and it is not a vice. So the Rambam goes into great detail about that, and then he makes a tremendous amount of the intellect, of what the mind is. And he explains how one can reach the heights, how one can reach intellectual heights. And if you want to, I will read to you the appropriate part in the Rambam if you're interested. He says, now this is in the fifth chapter, and in the previous four chapters he has spoken about the intellect of the human being, how great it is, what can be done with it. And now he says, and a man must always have in mind one purpose. And what is that purpose? That is, in order to comprehend God, to comprehend divinity, to comprehend godliness according to his ability, according to his intellectual ability, which changes with each person. But that is the goal that everyone has got to set himself. Now, that is a very important statement. What is he saying? That is the Ein Od Milvadeh. The actuality of it is, the reality is it, of it is, the Ein Od Milvadeh. There is none else but Hashem. And if one goes through everything, and you heard me speaking about this on Shabbos morning a week ago, if one goes through everything, one must inevitably come to the conclusion that there is a God. One goes to the very source, that is the cause of all causes and the source of all sources. So if that is the reality, says the Rambam, that the intellect of a person must be geared in order to understand, to comprehend that reality, which is God. The yosin to unosov kulam to unosov unosov v'chodavarov may be mazehak tachlis, he says, and what he must do is, he must orientate himself in such a way that his deeds, his movements, and even when he isn't doing anything, and all his speech must bring him to this tachlis, to this goal, until he reaches a stage that in everything that he does, there is nothing that he does that isn't for this purpose. Now, that is the life that the Rambam lived. That was the life that he lived. Whatever he did only for that purpose. Of course, it's something that is, it is so great that we cannot even understand how it is possible for the person to reach anything like that. I am in the very fortunate position that I've seen people who live their lives like that. It may not have been 100%, but can you imagine what it is like to have 75% of that? But I've seen this, where the whole life of the person has been only directed towards that. Nothing else. Everything he says, everything he does, only for that purpose. And then he goes on to say, and to give you just an example, whether he eats, whether he drinks, his sexual life, his sleep, his awake, his movements,
when he's relaxing the health of his body, everything is to be directed only to that purpose. So it simply means, so what it comes out to is that there is then the whole life of a person is a life of direction and is a life of purpose. It is to achieve that, to achieve the understanding of God. Still not here, it's still not the fear of God. But what a wonderful foundation it is for the fear of God. This is already a beginning for the fear of God, but still hasn't got it. That comes afterwards. And then the Siddur Shorim says, when Shlomo says, if you will seek it like silver and search for it like God, like gold, all stovin, then you will understand Yiras Hashem, but you still haven't got it. You will understand it, but you still haven't got it. To get it, for that you've got to work very hard. And that is the purpose of the whole of Masilas Yeshurim, where he teaches you that is how you get it. And you get it only in the laboratory. You get it only in the workshop. You don't get it in the classroom, and you don't get it in the lecture hall. It's only by working on it that you get it. And how do you get it? By controlling oneself. But controlling oneself to such a degree, and this is because Hashem said that, that's the way you've got to do it. Now, let me just, I'll just take one particular aspect of it. That is that when one does something or one doesn't do it, and Yiro, fear of God, applies to not doing wrong. Doing that which is right is governed by love of God. So, I'm going to tell you that I want to deal with something that's not usual. I don't want to deal with things that you mustn't tell a lie, you mustn't steal, you mustn't speak Yoshe Bora. We know all that. I want to tell you something and see how it is dealt with, how the Torah deals with it. We are told that it is wrong to reveal a secret that has been told me. Somebody tells me something and it's a secret. Then it is wrong of me to reveal it. Why is it wrong of me to reveal it? So the Rabbeinu Yonah gives three reasons. And I'm trying to remember the three reasons. The first reason, he says, is because it damages the person who told you the secret. He might have told you a secret, he intends doing this in business. And you speak about it, somebody else does it before him, gets in before him, and now he can't do it anymore. So you do it wrong. But it's possible that he has told you something that if you reveal it to another person, it won't do any harm. Says a very interesting thing. He says, but it's not sneers. Somebody told you something, and it is a secret. It is covered, and you uncover it. See, that isn't sneers. Now, what is sneers? Sneers is covering up. When it's concerning the body of a person, it's covering up as much of the body as one can. Doesn't apply only to women, it applies to men also. To men also. What a difference it is if a man comes into shul in short trousers, short pants, without a shirt, no socks, and sandals with his toes sticking out. Walks into shul. That's the way he likes to go dressed. It's not sneers. But sneers applies to everything. If a person speaks loudly, shouts, it's not sneers. One reduces the volume of one's voice. Understatement is so desirable according to the Torah. That is sneers. It's an understatement. Not projecting one's image, not projecting one's personality, not projecting one's presence. One is at the wedding, and the Gemara speaks about it. Hatzmeya leches, to walk with sneers, to go about with sneers. That even at a wedding, when you are expected to be Masameach Chotam Lekala, to make it happy, to make it a happy occasion, to make it a jolly occasion. But don't project yourself. Do it quietly. That is sneers. That is what the Torah demands of us. So the Basilis is showing us this. To tell something that he's told you, that's not sneers. Sneers is covering up. And it is given to you as something that should be covered up. And you go and take the cover off and you expose it. So it's on the same level as exposing too much of one's body. You're exposing something. That's the second point, sneers. Then he says, but there's a third question. He says, in another place, the Masilah of the Year, Rabbeinu Yonah speaks. He said, when you know about Loshon Hara, as to speak Loshon Hara, he says there are two types of people who speak Loshon Hara. One is a pathological slanderer. He's always slandering. I'm not dealing with that person. Speaking about Loshon Hara, now, the Gemara says that the majority of people in some way or other transgress the law of you shall not steal. The majority of people. I take a seedle from somebody's seed and I don't put it back. I haven't taken it, but I don't put it back. That already falls under the category of stealing. I cause the other person, when he comes, he's got to go and look for it, he's got to go and search for it. That is already stealing. So the Gemara says the majority of people, somehow or other, transgress the law of you shall not steal. The minority of people, says the Gemara, somehow or other, transgress the laws of sexual morality. It's in those days, not speaking about California. In those days, the minority of people, somehow or other, says the Gemara, that everybody is guilty, if not of Loshon Hara, but of Avat Loshon Hara. Avat Loshon Hara is, it brings to Loshon Hara. For example, I'm speaking to a person about another person, and I'm saying, you know what a wonderful person this is. He's so charitable and he's so good to everybody. And the other person listens, very nice. He says, and all this, he does it so unostentatiously. Stuart. He says, you know, he doesn't even expect any publicity for it. Now then the other person can't even contain himself anymore. And he says, no, he doesn't expect publicity. Did you see that article? With his picture in the paper. From where did the picture get? Where did the paper get the picture? Where do you think he got? He gave it to them. He's already speaking Loshon Hara. But the person who told him what a wonderful person it is, he caused him to speak it. So he is guilty of second degree Loshon Hara. Torah says everybody is guilty. Of that, everybody, nobody escapes that. Of that nobody escapes second degree Loshon Hara. Now, says the Rabbeinu Yonah, what causes that? It's a loose tongue. That's just a loose tongue. If a person tells you a secret and you reveal it, that's a loose tongue. Now, not only is it a loose tongue, but when you reveal that secret, then you acquire, even to a greater degree, this attribute, and it's a bad attribute, of having a loose tongue. Now, can you imagine the amount of the exercise of restraint that requires? And it all comes into one particular sphere, the restraint that all that requires. Not to speak. even when you're speaking good about a person. Just be careful how far you go can cause that. Somebody tells you something, be careful not to repeat it. Just one small matter. And why? That's what Hashem requires of me. So it's very easy to say, I have nothing wrong in it. What did I do wrong? I didn't harm him. But if he would know that you told it, he would be unhappy about it. That that is wrong. What prevents a person from doing that? That is only Yiras Hashem. Fear of Hashem. Hashem told me it's wrong to do it. Fear of Hashem. You don't get it in the classroom, you don't get it in the lecture hall, you don't get it from books. You get it only from practice. And that is Musar. The practice of all that. And it is through the practice of it all that one acquires Hiras Hashem. Here you've got Hashem says to give them, go down and you will conquer them. So he's got to have emuno, he's got to have belief that he's got. He's got to have trust, he's got to have faith. When it comes to belief, intellectually you can believe. When it comes to have faith, that requires very much more than intellectuality. Emuno he's got. Faith. There are degrees of faith. And every person is not at the same stage of faith at any particular time of his life. Yesterday he may have reached a certain stage in faith. Today it can be more or it can be less. But faith is something that is quite different. Love of God, fear of God, these things are quite different. And so when Gideon is told by Hashem, go down because I've given it into your hand. It is yours. Is it your God? Or I can wait for you.
Excuse me.
For 120 years. And in the end, the Torah tells us, and Noah went into the ark because of waters of the flood. He waited till the last moment. And the Torah Shebarfe explains it to us. He waited till the last moment. He believed and he didn't believe. He believed, Hashem said the flood is going to come. He believed and he didn't believe. He was Ketanei Amona. He was a man who was limited in his faith. Not in his belief, but in his faith he was limited. He believed and he didn't believe. Now, I think we're all in that category. We believe, and we have faith. We have faith and we don't have faith. Just to have faith alone, even if it's the Ketanei Amona, that we believe and we don't believe, it's also a very high level. What did you want to say, Ed?
Maybe you don't want to take the time now, but I have a
personal problem with the difference between belief and faith.
Yes, I can explain it very easily. It's belief, and you've got to take belief and trust, you see. Take that. Belief in God and trust in God. Belief in God is to believe that there is a God. That's one thing. Now, to trust God is, God says that the seventh year you are not allowed to sow your fields, not allowed to reap your fields, not allowed to put a fence around your fields. If there is a fence, the gate must be open. Anybody can come and take. So you might say, well, but what are we going to eat? Hashem says, don't worry. You have enough the sixth year. The sixth year we have to give you enough for the seventh year and the eighth year. Because if you don't plow your field and you don't sow in the sixth, in the seventh year, you won't have in the eighth year. Hashem says, don't worry, you will have. So it's a question, do you trust God or don't you trust God? That is trust. Faith is a combination of belief and trust. Am I making myself clear?
Very good.
It's the combination of faith. Now, the Chovas HaLevavos, for example, says you can have belief, but you haven't got faith, you haven't got trust, you haven't got faith. Belief you can have. He says, but you can't have faith and not have belief. That is impossible. And he gives a beautiful example, as he always does. He said, you can have a tree that is a non-fruit-bearing tree. What do they call these trees? Birches. Do they have birches here? It's a non-fruit-bearing tree. And you've got fruit-bearing trees. So the Chovas HaLevavos says, you can have a tree that doesn't bear fruit, but you can't have fruit without a tree. You can have a tree without fruit, but you can't have fruit without a tree. He says you can have emunah, you can have belief, without trust and faith. But you can't have trust and faith without belief, that you can't do. So, faith is, belief is something that is difficult, it must be acquired. But faith, that is very difficult. We work for it. He that fear is still afraid, hasn't got that faith. He's got a tremendous amount of faith. But it's no good God saying him, but I'm telling you it's all right. You don't get it in the lecture room. You don't get it in the classroom. You don't get it on tapes. You don't get it from books. Got to work for it. That he hasn't got. He's got faith, but so much that with 300 people he can go in. It's against all the laws of nature. 300 people, and they're going to fight these people, these hordes down below. What chance has he got? Faith. Now, it's all very well saying, well, Hashem told me so, I believe it. That's not faith. If he's got any doubt in his mind, if he's got any fear, shows that he hasn't got faith. So the only way to do it is, go down. Go down, see, he goes down and he overhears this conversation. Now that is the shiur for this evening. I still have to explain to you what is the meaning of this cake of barley that he's rolling down. What is the significance of the cake of barley? Those are things I still have to explain to you, but that is much easier. But if you want to ask me any questions on that, you can ask me now. I'm always telling people about the introduction in the first chapter of the Mesilas Yesharim, but I want you to know. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I've gone over it. And never, when I get over it, don't I find something that I haven't noticed before.
Who wrote the Mesilas Yesharim?
The Pesha Chaim Yitzchak.
Yeah, he was in Spain.
No. He was born in Italy, and he lived in Amsterdam, and he wrote his book in Amsterdam. But Amsterdam in those days was a respectable city. No, it was later. This must be about 1700. Just before.
full safety in Africa. He had a very hard time. He had a terribly hard time. And he wrote the Masila Shishori. Even today, if I read it once, then tons of times, I'll never read that introduction or that first chapter that I won't find something that has escaped me until then. It's just a remarkable piece of work. The Vilna Gaon says that in the first 11 chapters of the Masila Shishori, there isn't one unnecessary word. I think he said not one unnecessary letter. Not a single letter that is unnecessary. But I don't remember, so I'm saying that he certainly said not one unnecessary word.
How is the English translation?
There have been two English translations. The one was a terrible one. It was done by Mordechai Kaplan. And it was cold, detached, without any soul. This one is quite a different one. Its soul, its feeling into the translation. It's nothing like the original. It's just no comparison. It just doesn't bear any type of comparison to the original. To such an extent that when in the second half of the 19th century, when they started reviving modern Hebrew, they took this as an example of modern Hebrew. Although it was written 150 years earlier, they took this as an example of how one can take the Hebrew language and write a work on it. This was taken as an example. But sometimes I've taken it and I've taken a couple of sentences. See, can one make it any shorter than it is? Even a letter, you can't even take a letter out. I pointed out to Seymour Rosenberg once when he was doing the Masila Shishori. There is in Hebrew a certain construction of a word where you can use a yud or a hey. He uses the yud because it's less than the hey. To such an extent, to such a degree. Suggest that. And it might interest you today, I mentioned it to my son. My maternal great-grandfather and my maternal grandfather, that was his son, had evidently a very great respect for Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. They had plays that he wrote, and I inherited it. And these plays, of course, they were very, what do you call it? Just can't think of the English word for it. Anyway, they were plays, but of course it was to present an idea, like Shir HaShirim. And you have the actors, the beautiful plays in poetry. He wrote it in poetry, these plays. In fact, I don't even see them mentioned. Suppose in the encyclopedia they mentioned them. But these were plays that he wrote. And he suffered a lot on account of those plays because he was criticized for it. But really these plays were some very deep thoughts, Kabbalistic ideas. And he... so that was the Masila Shishori.
When we were running the Shira on
yes.
His brilliant show, he must have been one of the most brilliant men.
Just of all. I mean, to imagine the Vilna Gaon, if the Vilna Gaon said, and when the Vilna Gaon died, there were only two books that were found within two scoring. One was a Tanakh, the whole of the Torah of Yom Kisuvim, and the Masila Shishori. Those were the only two. The rest he knew by heart, but he said it to you. We've got such treasures. This is the classical safer for Musa. You can't move without it. There are many Musas for him, but this we just can't move without. Any questions? Yes.
How did it turn out that the Midianites became an enemy of Israel? Particularly since Jethro had been a priest among the Midianites.
Yes. Jephthah was a priest amongst the Midianites, but he wasn't a Midianite.
He
wasn't? No. He was a priest there. He'd been living in Egypt, and when all this started with the Jews, he couldn't take it, so he fled. And he was in Midian. But in Midian also, when he started believing God, they put him into Coventry. They sent him into Coventry. Do they use that expression here?
No.
You don't know what that means?
Someplace in England, right?
Exile to
Siberia?
No, it's not literally. That means they ostracized him.
Oh.
They use that word in California.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They ostracized him. That's what it means. They shunned him. Had nothing to do with him. And it can be quite a painful experience. But he was just a priest there, but he wasn't a Midianite himself. Have you heard of Yehoshua Feinstein? Yehoshua Feinstein, he wasn't an American. He lived in America. He lived in America for nearly 50 years. But he wasn't an American. So Yitzhak lived in Midian and Yehoshua Feinstein served America. He served for a long time. He was never an American. He might have been naturalized at that point. I suppose he did have an American passport. He wasn't in America. So he also was a priest in Midian, but he wasn't a Midianite. How's Sharon?
Progressing slowly.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.